to the Star Trek Retrospective by Film Strip Podcast.
My friends, we've come home.
Our host will boldly follow the voyages and crews of the Starship Enterprise.
It is not logical.
These podcasts will be spoiler-filled as we discuss the plots, characters, and themes of the Star Trek movies.
Neither believe nor doubt.
Now, on with our show.
Make it so.
Welcome back to the Star Trek Retrospective by Film Strip Podcast. I'm Jay.
And I'm Nathan.
And today we're here to talk about Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, starring William Shatner, Leonard Nimoy, DeForest Kelly, James Doohan, George Takei, Walter Koenig, Nichelle Nichols, and Ricardo Montalban. Written by Harve Bennett, Jack B. Sowards, and probably 15 other people that we're not going to name on this show. Directed by Nicholas Meyer, released in June of 1982 on a $12 million budget, so big drop from the last time. Grossed $97 million at the box office, and everyone will tell you it's pretty much the reason there is a Star Trek cinematic world is because this movie was such a smash. The last one we talked about made a lot of money, you know, almost $140 million in the initial run, but it cost 80 or so to make, and there were lots of other production costs and issues and stuff. The story of how this one came together is absolutely wild, though, because it's you couldn't have the same group of people producing a movie or a movie franchise approach it so differently than they did the first time.
Yes, not just in terms of costs, not just in terms of storyline, but in terms of costume, in terms of, I mean, there's a lot of reasons for this, as I'm sure we're going to dive into. But yeah, I can't wait to dive into this. There's a lot to unpack here.
Yeah, there's quite a bit to unpack. So let's actually start in the backstory of this. So Harve Bennett comes in, is brought in as a producer. They move Roddenberry into a different place. And that's a nice way of saying they basically kick him out of his own club.
Well, basically, all the reasons why Star Trek the Motion Picture ran so long and the cost was so high is Roddenberry kept making change and change and change and change. And the cost went up and up and up and up. And that's why hence the delay and the lack of editing that came about. So this time around, Paramount says, okay, you can be involved, but you're going to have to give up some control. And Gene Roddenberry basically says, look, either I have full control or no control. And they said, fine, zero control. We got to keep this under budget. In comes Harve Bennett. In comes Nicholas Meyer. And the result, we get something that, you know, it's not very much the traditional utopian Star Trek we see. It's a very, very dark film. But most Trekkies will say this is their favorite film.
Yeah, and I want to get into that in a little bit, but I do think one thing is neat. Nicholas Meyer had famously said he had never seen any of the show, didn't know anything about it, so he thought that fresh perspective would be good. Harve Bennett went back and started rewatching the old shows, and one thing he thought was that the first movie leaned into the sci-fi utopia part of Star Trek, but he thought there was another part of the Star Trek show that movie had ignored, and that was the swashbuckling aspect. And yes, if you go back and watch the original series, there is a lot of adventure to it. There is a lot of sort of Robin Hood and all of that. And he was looking for a big bad because he felt like V'ger coming back being misunderstood was not good enough of a villain to do.
Right.
So we got to have a villain. And he was going through, and in season one, episode, I forget which one it is exactly, Space Seed comes in. Yeah. And he's like, there's our villain. There's our person, because Ricardo Montalban, when he did that show, was just an actor. You know, they just brought him in. They did that one episode and it was just kind of gone. You know, it came, went, whatever, you know, and it was well received, but nobody remembered any of it. So it was a bold idea to go, we're going to go drag up a villain from a show that people don't have ready access to. This, you can't like just flip it on Paramount Plus and watch it like I did, you know, before watching this movie. You would have had to have caught it on syndication. If you owned a VCR in the 80s, you were super rich and you weren't taping stuff off TV yet. So nobody would remember this. You have to introduce people to something only the most diehard fan would even remember. You got to give him that backstory without spending a ton of time retelling it. And you got to have all that happen inside of a, you know, less than 2 hour movie. And that's a bold task, man.
Yeah, it is. And I would love to see the stats, the percentage of people, even Trekkies who saw Star Trek II before they saw Space Seed.
Right.
I know I was one. I mean, when mm-hmm. I when the movie came out as a kid, I had no idea who Khan was. No. But it wasn't until the reruns later on TV that I was like, oh, I remember this guy. That's the guy that was in the movie. Yeah. So it's, you know, interesting little tidbit about Ricardo Montalban. He there's a myth that his chest was prosthetic.
Yeah,
that was his actual chest.
Yeah, yeah, like, they talk about
worked
that.
Out. Yeah, yeah, he was like actually a physical dude. Yeah.
Yeah, he was a very fit dude. I think he was like 60 when they made this movie. Mm-hmm. And the Nicholas Meyer said he was blown away by like how much of a workout guy this guy still was. You know, even at that age, is that he was just a specimen of a person. And obviously, I mean, you know, if he's Fantasy Island, he's had a whole career doing lots of things, played a lot of bad guys, played a lot of good guys. But this is just one of those scene stealing, iconic roles. I feel like the early 80s gave us a few of these things, Nate. Like nobody mm-hmm. necessarily thinks about it automatically, but James Earl Jones as Thulsa Doom and Conan the Barbarian is one of the greatest cinematic villains of all time. And it's like,
oh, for sure.
James Earl Jones is not, he's not doing his Darth Vader voice. He's doing his homely Terrence voice from Field of Dreams, and he's this freaking snake monster, you know, spoiler alert for Conan, but you know, he's so good in it because you get these actors with gravitas, you know, and Ricardo yeah. Montalban full of gravitas, you know. And if you know, I didn't know it was based on anybody from the show. That was the internet that taught me that, man. So that tells you how long ago, you know, 15 years ago I learned that, or 20 years ago, and I went and looked up the episode and watched it, and I was like, I get it. I get why this would be something you could hang a story around, because one, that Space Seed story is great. And it's a good contained story. It's this idea that in the late 1990s, genetic manipulation had gotten to the point where we created a race of supermen to take over the world, and they were all dictators, real surprise. And yeah. then yeah. as we settled into some bit of peace, we shot them off into space as a kind of like a Superman 2 prison thing, you know,
yeah.
a little bit of
yeah.
that. But and the Enterprise comes across them, because as you're exploring strange new worlds, you come across space junk. They wake him up, and of course, the first thing Khan does is learn everything he can about the ship. He absorbs all this information. He's super smart. He seduces the historian, which I'm going to come back to because that's your line of work, and I want to see how well that would have worked. Gets her and tries to throw over yeah. the Enterprise, and it's a pretty, like, you know, harrowing moment where he's trying to kill Kirk and Spock and everybody else. Eventually, the Enterprise wins out, but Kirk decides, instead of throwing this guy in space jail, you know, and all this stuff, he sends him off to a desolate but inhabitable planet to see, can you create your utopia, your society down there? And, you know, I think one of the last lines is like, it'll be neat to come back and see whatever happens with this. Of course, they never do. And that's part of this.
In like 100 years is what they're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's going to be, you know, 15, I guess, in storyline. It's, you know, of course, 20 or so when it's over.
Well, actually, yeah, exactly. So it was, and actually it was 15 years storyline, 15 years in real time too.
Oh, you're right. Yeah. Okay. You're right. Yeah. Yeah. No. Yeah. I was off on that, but no, but it's a great idea. And it, of all the things they could have chosen, I think what Bennett saw in this was, I've got my big bad villain, right? I've got an actor that will come back and do it, and he'll have all the screen presence in the world. And it'll give me an excuse, because there was this whole sense of, we want to deal with these themes of growing older and loss, and how do we deal with that as an adult? And, you know, Kirk has this reputation on the show in particular of being this guy who just cheats death and literally cheats his way around the galaxy in a lot of ways, right? And what happens when that bill finally comes due for that person, you know, for when Robin Hood can no longer pull out the sword and swashbuckle his way through, he's actually got to, like, he's going to pay for it. I think of the Cape Fear line with Max Cady, De Niro talking to Nicholas Nolte, saying, you're going to learn a lot about loss, you know, and that's in that original story. And I remember sort of that theme here. This whole thing is really built around the idea of Kirk is going to have to deal with loss and consequences on a lot of levels that he's never had to before. And
right,
it's a smart way of doing it.
Yeah, no, I think it's a very smart way, because he's all, like you said, he's the swashbuckler. He always finds a way out. And mm-hmm. I think Kobayashi Maru comes into the Forever Trek lexicon to describe a no-win scenario, not just in sci-fi, but just, I mean, heck, I use it at work sometimes. Like, well, nobody's going to win on this. This is the Kobayashi. This is straight up Kobayashi Maru here. Mm-hmm. And that's the tale. I mean, I think it's fitting that it starts off with the Kobayashi Maru and Spock saying at the end, you know, I've never taken the Kobayashi Maru test until now. And Kirk is faced with his own Kobayashi Maru. Like, okay, what you're used to doing all of a sudden, the bill is due. Like you said, the bill has to come due at some point.
And we're going to tie together a lot of things. And I mean, I know it's also part of the story that the only way Nimoy wanted to come back is he said, oh, you got to kill me. He's sort of pulling a Harrison Ford, like, I got to die. I can't.
It's interesting the people that had to be convinced to come back. Like, that was the only reason Nimoy was going to come back. And he originally wanted to die in the opening scene. Mm-hmm. But they rewrote that to say, no, here's the script. This is what we want to do instead. And George Takei did not want to come back. And ironically, it was William Shatner who convinced him to come back. Of all people, it was William Shatner to convince him to come back.
Yes, their rivalry is infamous these days.
Yeah, yes, it is. Yes,
they,
it is.
They do not like each other, and they don't even have a lot of scenes together. So
no, they really don't.
They're almost blocked and staged in such a way to do that. But I do think it was neat that Nimoy wanted to die, and then he read the script and was like, oh, actually, I kind of like this. And so he liked it so much that they created a very interesting ending that the director completely disavows. Like, the last shot, he's like, nope, that's not how that was supposed to go. I didn't have nothing to do with that. We'll get there. We get there, but this turned a lot of people back into it. Now, I think everybody else was like, yeah, sure, I'll come along for the ride. And what I love here, we talk about, we get into it, is how everybody, we felt like last time, like, we really couldn't give everybody a lot to do because we had so many characters and we were trying to introduce new people and all this mystery. Whereas this time, everybody gets a lot to do, and we still get to introduce new characters and, you know, bring people in, and, you know, this Carol Marcus and David and all of that stuff. It's the same kind of arc and piece that we had from the first movie, but just done on speed, you know, like and I don't mean the drug. I mean, like, fast, you know, like, we're going to do this. Aaron's working.
Yeah.
We're going to walk it through. We're going to blow through all this, and it can work, and it can work when the script is really well done. And so I saw this as a kid on television. Like, it was just one of those, like, it came on and I was too young to go to the theater at that point, I think. And my parents weren't big Trek fans, so we saw this on television, but loved it, you know, and just really got into it. And then I saw the next several Star Trek movies in theaters because of this. And so I remember this one being a big deal on home video and, you know, the Showtime HBO situation and all of that back then. But when it would come on cable, you know, it was always a big deal before everything was so, you know, readily available like it is now. It was neat when this would come on because this was right in the middle of Star Wars pandemonium. I mean, we had had Star Wars, had Empire Strikes Back, and it was, you know, a year before Return of the Jedi was coming out. But everybody knew about that movie. And it, you know, it was before the internet, but it was in every magazine. People were talking about it all the time. You knew that was going to be huge. The people from Paramount knew, we got to get this thing here or it's never going to happen.
Yeah, no, that's true. And it's a lot of ways, you know, they say Star Trek Motion Picture is one that brought Star Trek back to the big screen. I think Star Trek II was the one that kept it going.
Yeah.
Because it was so good. And then the huge demand from the fan base, like, you can't kill Spock like this. This cannot be the end. There's no way this can be the end.
Yeah.
And so that extra scene got popped in there. And Leonard Nimoy, even when he watched it in the theater for the first time, was like, oh, they're going to bring me back.
Yeah. Yeah. He was not aware at that moment. as we'll get to. But I do think, too, it's neat to notice, too, that the next three movies are as close a trilogy of connected stories as any of these things get, because the Star Trek universe has always been one that it was an adventure next to an adventure next to an adventure. They didn't always have to tie together. There were little things that did, but this is a three line. That's a three movie arc.
It is a trilogy. It's literally when the first movie ends, the next movie takes place immediately after. There's no time period that changes between that. It is like literally the next day.
Yeah. Yeah. It's only been a couple of years and stuff. And so basically they get back and this is what's happened. The only thing that's different is, like you say, we're going to change up the uniforms. We're going to get out of that awful sauna thing we had going on last time, which we'll talk about the unis in a minute. But I think they made a great costume choice there. We're going to do a few little updates to the Enterprise, but not a ton. We're going to sell the idea that you can run one of these starships that's supposed to be an aircraft carrier, supposed to be 800 people in this thing, that you could actually really run it with about 20, maybe even less people if you needed to. We're going to, because they're introducing an idea they're going to play up on later. They had it, you know, Harv Bennett had the idea where this would go, didn't have it fleshed out, but had the notes of where to go next as we go. But I think we've got to get into the plot summary now, Nate. So again, if by chance you didn't listen to our first episode, go back and do that. But in the spirit of all these movies and transparency, I felt like it would be good to use AI to write the plot summary. So according to Google's AI bar, here's the plot summary for Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. It's the year 2285. Admiral James T. Kirk is feeling restless and unfulfilled in his desk job at Starfleet Academy. He's basically just running around, ordering tests, things like that. It's not really his cup of tea, as we know, because he wants to be out amongst the galaxy. He longs for the days of adventure in his command. And meanwhile, on a desolate planetoid, Khan Noonien Singh, a genetically engineered superhuman that Kirk exiled there 15 years ago, is waiting for his chance for revenge. And with the help of his loyal crew, he's able to hijack the USS Reliant, a starship commanded by Kirk's former cadet, Captain Terrell, and also with Lieutenant Chekov at this point? I can't remember. Commander Chekov. And also
Lieutenant
with
Commander Chekov, yeah.
Yeah, with Lieutenant Commander Chekov there, who were investigating the planetoid that Khan is on, because they were looking to test a new technology called the Genesis device, capable of terraforming a barren planet into a lush paradise. Of course, when Khan finds out about this, he wants to use the Genesis device to create a new home world for his people, and of course, exact revenge on Kirk for leaving him there. When Kirk left him there, it was a habitable planet, but the one next to it exploded, shifted the orbit, turned it into a desert wasteland. So So Kirk, sensing Khan's return, takes command of the aging Enterprise and is now relegated to basically training duty. And he's joined by his trusted crew, including Spock, McCoy, Scotty, Uhura's there. What's his name? Sulu's there. And Kirk sets out to go and on a training mission before he realizes something is wrong with Genesis. Something's wrong with the Reliant. They go and figure out what's up, and they find out Khan has taken over the Reliant, and he goes into a starship battle with him. The Reliant, you know, does a pretty bang up job of beating up the Enterprise, but using his wits and stuff and Kirk's ability to always seem to get out of the no-win scenario, they find a way to fire back on the Reliant, damage it a little bit, and basically hide from each other around the other side of a planet while Kirk goes and figures out what happened to the crew that built the Genesis device and what's going on. And as part of that, Kirk is confronted with another moment from his past. Dr. Carol Marcus is the lead engineer on the Genesis device, and her top assistant is her son, David, who's also Kirk's son. And to say they have a contentious relationship is putting it mildly. So Khan, of course, is fueled by vengeance, and of course, his superhuman abilities is a great foe for Kirk and his crew. And they finally go into another battle into a nebula because the Enterprise is so damaged, they can't really fight, you know, straight up against the Reliant anymore. But if they go into the nebula, nobody's shields work, and you know, you're in a pretty even fight. So we get a good space battle going on. The Enterprise finally deals the death blow to Reliant, but of course at a high cost because the Enterprise's warp drive is damaged. Spock intervenes, goes down there and fixes the warp drive just in time for the Enterprise to get away, because in his last dying breath, Khan has ignited the Genesis device, is going to blow up the starships together there. The Enterprise gets away and a new planetoid is formed from the explosion of the Reliant inside of that nebula. But of course, because of what Spock did, he's exposed to massive radiation and he dies, pledging his, you know, undying friendship and loyalty to Kirk. Kirk finally having to face loss for the first time in his life is also confronted with the, you know, relationship he never had with his son. And they begin to bond together as Kirk finally feels young again, even though the film ends on a somber note, and the Enterprise goes back to its home base. And that's the plot of Star Trek II, as it were. Lots of emotional stuff in this one, Nate. You know, if the last one was very buttoned up, if you would say, and this very much goes in the other direction.
Yeah, very much. This pulls at your heartstrings. There are scenes in there that if that doesn't get you, I mean, I'm sorry, but if Kirk's eulogy doesn't get you, then you're not a human being. It's very emotional. Yeah. And one of the things I do love about this, and we briefly touched upon it before, it's needs to be pointed out that the two best Star Trek films have basically, they take a lot from Moby Dick. Mm-hmm. I mean, Khan, First Contact and Wrath of Khan, and Khan throughout is quoting Ahab, which is interesting because we all know how it turns out for Ahab. You would think somebody as smart as Khan would know that maybe that's not the best guy to quote, you know, is in the end, you are consumed by revenge. And just as the, you know, Kirk in the Enterprise was his white whale, and he was willing to stop at nothing to extract his revenge. But I think a good revenge story by a good villain is also good. But yes, very, very emotional story. You also, we have a lot of the returning characters. Not going to lie, you get my favorite, one of my favorite characters of all time, and that's Lieutenant Savick. Young Kirstie Alley as Lieutenant Savick. Yes, please, every day, all day. she is my absolute like favorite Star Trek crush of all time. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting about her is the dynamic she had with Spock. And that was like basically her, that was her protege. So this is also a loss for her. And she was part Romulan, part Vulcan. So she was able to have some of those emotional responses. There was a lot of new things that were introduced in this, with still a lot of familiarity, which I think made a nice blend.
I think it's neat that you brought up the part about Moby Dick, because they do a shot when Chekhov and Captain Terrell are looking at this sort of trailer in the dirt down on the Seti Alpha 5 planet. And you see all these classic books, and Moby Dick's one of them. And they like zoom in on it. It's like, we're going to hammer that home. And my take on the idea of why he's always quoting that is that Khan thinks he's so much more superior physically, intellectually than everybody else, that, well, I can do what Ahab couldn't do. I can get my white whale, and I'm smart enough to survive it. And see, I mean, there's evidence to that. The fact that the man learns at an astronomical pace, that he's able to keep that many people alive, because he got sent down there with like 60, and he's maybe got what, 18, 20 left. And some of them are young, so they procreate. Mm-hmm. Like they've built new ones. Did. See, I mean, he's got some teenagers on that bridge. And that he taught all of them how to work a starship without having one handy, because they just brought in and take over the Reliant like it's no big problem.
And well, you also have to go ahead.
No, just go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, you also have to remember in Space Seed, they did have somebody down there who has knowledge of like contemporary starship functions in Marla McGivers, because she was the historian. I know we'll touch on that later, but she became Khan's wife, so she did have some of that knowledge. And the actress who played Marla McGivers was in bad health at the time, and that's why she wasn't cast. Hence why, you know, Khan says, you know, this creature killed 12 of my beloved crew, 12 of my crew, including my beloved wife.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you watch that original Space Seed and watch her and him and her get really kind of brought into him, it's almost like the way Dracula pulls in somebody, you know, like he's got her in a thrall, and it's just, you know, she's enamored with him. And some of that is probably the politics of the time and such, but also it's, you can see why somebody who's a historian would be fascinated by somebody like him, right?
Exactly. I think a good analogy as an historian, imagine that you're a professor of ancient Egyptian history, and somehow Cleopatra comes back.
Right.
And you've studied this person. You've studied their ways, their lives, their what they did for a living, what that life was like, how they got by, their foods, you know everything about them. And to have them physically in the flesh right there, the person you've been studying all this time, there would be that temptation to like, I want to be part of that. I'm willing to do what it takes to physically be a part of that world. Mm-hmm. And so I can see it. Like Marla McGivers was like, oh my God, this is my Cleopatra. This is my, you know, easily brainwashed in that scenario. Somebody who's a smart historian, but at the same time, when everything you study is now embodied in live flesh, how do you put up boundaries? And I don't think you can.
No, you can't. And you're right. It's a great setup for a villain. Like we've talked about, pulling one out of the OG series was great. We get an iconic villain, and we can get into him and Kirk in just a little bit in the way they go at each other. But I think it's neat to catch up with the old crew and the fact that they are all in different jobs now. You know, some of them are still on the Enterprise, still working. But what the Enterprise is now, it's the training vessel. So it was the flagship of the fleet, but it's not anymore because it's old. Its crew's old. It's been around, you know, and I mean, old in Star Trek is, you know, relative, but it's 15, 16 years old, maybe about this point. And they're using the ship because it's still viable, but Spock's a captain now. But he's not a go out there captain. He's a training captain. He's a school. He's the professor in a lot of ways.
Exactly.
He's the lead professor, and he's got his training crew, which includes Lieutenant Savick and a few others. But he's still got Scotty, you know, running the engineering. But mm-hmm. Scotty's almost like head of engineering now. He's sort of passing that down to other people. Sulu's still the helmsman, but he's got other jobs. Chekhov's on another ship. You know, he's got a new command. He's somewhere else. Exactly. Uhura, you know, comes back and she's still kind of hanging around the comms desk, but you feel like, you know, she could be transferred anywhere at any time. It's neat to watch all these people operating. And then you've got Kirk, who's really just there to push paper across the desk. Like it's like he came back from the Voyager thing and they're like, no, for real, you can't go anymore. Like they won't let him hear it.
And he is not, right at the beginning of the movie. It's his birthday. So that's the one thing to remember, that this is Kirk's birthday and he is not handling age well, and he's not handling being an admiral well, because now he's not out in the stars. Now he's not doing the one thing he's good at, being on the bridge of a ship. Mm-hmm. And when McCoy goes to visit him for his birthday, he says, you know, get your command back, get it before you become a part of this collection. Like he's got a nice collection of historical artifacts. Get it before you really grow old.
Yeah. And they're sitting by that fire, and there's that shot right when before McCoy comes in, where Kirk is looking out over, I guess we're supposed to think it's like San Francisco Bay or something.
Yeah, San Francisco. Yeah.
That's where Starfleet is located. So he's on Earth at this point, and he's looking out, and it reminds me so much of that shot in Michael Mann's Heat, when De Niro comes in and he lays his gun on the table and he's just looking out over that balcony, and there's really nothing, you know, it's a nice place, but there's really nothing around him, and he's just looking out into nothing. And Mann says he got that from a painting, and I don't know if Nicholas Meyer was inspired by the same thing or not, but it just reminded me of that, because it's this enigmatic personality there, and they're just so alone in that moment. And it's something to think about a guy like Kirk, because he's such a big personality, and you know, he's all the things, right? But he's lonely, and he's alone, and he's at that point in life where he's like, you know, he even says it to McCoy, you know, running around the galaxy is a young person's game, you know, and like the way he said it, though, is as if he has been had that said to him so many times that now he's just repeating it so that he starts to believe it a little bit, because I'm sure his commanders have said, no, you're not getting near one again. And he almost finagles his way into just doing a lap, you know, around Earth with this training crew, just so he can just get back on the ship. And it's almost like he trumps up like this. I'm going to do an inspection. That's what we'll call it. Sure. And, you know, he gets through one part of the inspection and they're like, what about the rest of it? And he's like, nah, later, you know, just get me on the bridge. Let's go out and have some fun, because he cannot stand being on the Earth. And it's, I don't know, it's a neat dichotomy, because Kirk, like we said, is known for always gets himself out of trouble. Right. So how do you put someone like that in stakes where they can't manipulate, you know, what they can do? And I think it's a neat way to sort of introduce to that. The first scene is the Kobayashi Maru test, where Savick is training as a captain. And the idea of the Kobayashi Maru is you stumble upon a ship that's disabled in the neutral zone. And explain to people who may not know what the heck the neutral zone is.
So the neutral zone is a line of demarcation between the Klingon Empire and the Federation. It's a demilitarized zone. It's sort of like a border. So imagine the 54th parallel between North and South Korea. That's what the neutral zone is. Mm-hmm. So you can't, one side can't go into the other. You Klingons can't go in there. Federation can't go. Any side that goes into that zone, that is considered an act of war.
Right.
And so when a Federation ship, the Kobayashi Maru, not a starship, but just a freighter, has its engine damage and it slowly drifts into the neutral zone, they need help. And in order to save them, you have to go into the neutral zone. And so that leads to, you know, the Klingons sending people out there to say, oh, you violated Federation treaty, we're coming after you. We're looking, it's the Klingons, they're a warrior race, so they'll look for any reason to start a fight.
Right. And that's what happens.
The neutral zone is. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what happens is Savick tries to do the right thing, get there, beam them up, get shot at, everything gets blown to hell. I got to say, that's a pretty wacky simulation to blow it all up and everybody like fake die. That's pretty wild.
But yeah, no, that was a very good. I will say the Kobayashi Maru test compared to the Star Trek reboot, this one was infinitely better.
Yes. Oh, infinitely way better. Yeah, better. We're going to get to that. Yeah, soon. But I love the idea that Kirk is, and Bones is the one that sets it up, is that that's the only person that ever beat the test. And he'll reveal later to Savick that the way he did it was he failed it twice. And before he took it the third time, he went in and reprogrammed the computer that gave him enough time to get the ship out and get back out of neutral zone before the Klingons could cross it. Because he said, I don't believe in a no-win scenario. I don't think it's fair. I think there's always an option. There's always a chance. And in some ways, you can praise Kirk for that kind of optimism and leadership quality, because that's the kind of person that's never going to quit on the other side of it. But what it breeds is somebody who never has to deal with loss. And if you never lose, you don't know what it's like. You know, you don't know how to handle it. I mean, to make a modern comparison and use sports for a minute, Nick Saban retired from Alabama after the greatest run of two decades of college football. And that team disassembles very quickly behind him. And Alabama fans lost their minds because there's a generation of them that have never seen anything but complete dominance. And I'm like, welcome to the rest of the world all of us live in. You know, I mean, that's the whole point, is that Kirk has lived above this for so long, and he's really lived above responsibility for so long, even though he's been in command for decades. Because he's so witty and he's smart and he gets out of it.
But he pushes those lines all the time in series and stuff. And it's even mentioned. I remember there was a Deep Space Nine episode where it was the one where the crew of Deep Space Nine goes back and visits the Enterprise, the original series Enterprise. And right before that happened, these people from the time agency from Starfleet came. And when Sisko mentioned Kirk, they both rolled their eyes like, oh my God, this guy had two dozen different violations. The man was a menace.
Yes.
Like this guy, I mean, Kirk just always like, okay, whatever. There's some rules out there, but those are just for people who don't like to take chances. And that's what he does. Yeah. And I'm not gonna, as a museum director, as somebody that is in charge.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how many times on a weekly and daily basis I think of how would Kirk handle this.
Yeah.
Like I also do not believe in the no-win scenario. Like I don't like to lose. I'm an extremely competitive person and I imagine, okay, how would Kirk handle this situation? I do that quite frequently.
Yeah. And I mean, the truth is there's some merit to what his solve is for that test too. It's like, this is an impossible situation. Is that ever really going to happen? Probably not. I could probably fake my way out of it. And as we'll see later, he uses a computer trick to get out of a no-win scenario. Yes. So it's not,
it's great. Yeah.
It's not far-fetched. And I give a lot of credit again to the script for that, because much like, you know, you talk about Hollywood tight scripts, and I think the one that most people from the 20th century in particular really hold on to is like the tightest script ever written was Back to the Future, because everything sets up something and pays off something, and it's just
it is a great
script. But this one is right up there with it in terms of every little thing it sets up, it's going to pay off immediately. It's not going to pay it off three movies later or any of that stuff like a TV show would. We're going to pay it off now, because, and again, I think Harv Bennett and the people at Paramount knew, if this isn't a massive hit, then this is it. Like, there will be no more Star Trek. And the fact that it was is the reason there's still Star Trek today. So, I mean, imagine if in the alternate universe timeline that this series likes to play with, this movie's a bomb and we never have anything else.
It's like I was saying earlier, like this was like, okay, if this bombs, at least there's closure. If it doesn't bomb, then hey, we're going to make some more movies, but we're not going to stretch it out. I mean, as we see later, that the Genesis storyline takes place over three movies, but they didn't see that coming at the time. They're like, well, you know, if it ends, it ends, you know.
Well, and I think that's a great MacGuffin that they introduce into this. And I know it went through a lot of iterations before they came back to the idea of calling it Genesis or whatever. But this idea that geneticists would create something that would be basically funded by the military, right, to create something that we can create life where there's nothing there, because, you know, our resources are depleting, even though we've gotten smarter about that in the 23rd century and all that. Some point we're going to need to colonize elsewhere. Look what we could do with this. And I kid you not, this morning I read about a type of camouflage the military is creating that's akin to the invisibility cloak from the Harry Potter series.
Oh, wow.
But they say like it's also going to be great for environmental observation because one of the hardest things to do in nature is observe. And I'm like, I'm sure okay. that got a little funding tag on to it. That's not
what yeah, I'm sure. Yeah.
But what I love about this is that you do have this people on regular one, the space station, who have been tasked with creating this thing. Right. Mm-hmm. And that they are Federation, but they're not military. You know, right. they are pure scientists and
they're not Starfleet. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They're like contractors. Right. And mm-hmm. so and the fact that we give two of them a direct tie to Kirk is amazing. But I love the whole concept of the Genesis team and the Genesis torpedo and the whole device. And Carol Marcus, that character is so much fun. And I wanted to ask you, that's a creation for the movie here, right? Like she was not something from the show. No,
she was not from the show. Like we all learn about this in the movie.
Okay.
And you know, talk about Genesis a second. I thought that was an interesting concept because then this is a game changer. And mm-hmm. As far as like what civilizations can do now. And mm-hmm. it's like McCoy says, McCoy does not like this. When it was Kirk and Spock and McCoy watching the Genesis video,
mm-hmm.
McCoy was like, this is insane. This is too much power. You know, you took, he says, you know, the Bible says that we created, you know, God created Earth in 6 days. Now watch out. We can create it in 6 minutes.
Yeah.
And Spock says, it's always been easier to destroy than create. And that's when McCoy says, not anymore. And now we can do it in 6 minutes. Side and a little tie in to, the video, the Genesis video that they're watching, that was the first computer-generated video ever done. And it was done by people who would eventually go and start up this new small little company called Pixar much later. I thought was fascinating.
And you know what? It still holds up. It looks really good. I know they've gone in and smoothed images and stuff like that. But you know, I watched the digital transfer of this on Apple, and it looked amazing. I was like, this still looks really, really good. And I was impressed with, and in 1982, I mean, when I saw this as a kid, I was blown away. I didn't know you could have stuff like that. You know, nothing looked like that. Not even Star Wars looked like that, you know? And so this is something totally Star Trek had in front of Star Wars, was completely computer generated effects. So,
yeah.
So, but it was neat to see. And I Bebe Bash, who plays Carol Marcus in the movie here, just really gets it. You can tell she's from a different time of Hollywood, and then they brought her back for this, and somebody who's got this sort of whip smart world weariness to her, but also the ability to play that eternal curiosity that a scientist has. You know, she's just always asking the questions. She's the calm one in the room, even though she definitely has emotional reactions to things, but she's the one keeping everybody together. And the idea that, you know, as we find out through dialogue, you know, Kirk says, I did what you asked. I stayed away. I didn't bother you or him. And she said, what were we going to do? Were we going to be together? So it was like a hookup, like her and Kirk hooked up. Yeah. She got pregnant and said, I want him with me, not with you. And Kirk said, okay, cool. And that was it. I mean, I love how
that was really it. Yeah.
It's like a 2 minute scene, but there's so much in that. And, you know, people bang on Shatner for lots of things, and some of it's, you know, worth it, I guess, but he really nails the emotional complexity of what his character is going through as a middle-aged man who's successful in his career, but doesn't feel useful anymore, who's now being confronted with things he's never had to confront before. Also being confronted with his past on two different levels. That takes a lot of skill to pull that off.
Oh, and he did it brilliantly. And I think that Harold Marks, they got the actress just right. This had to be somebody that you could actually see, somebody that was smart, but you could actually see hooking up with Kirk.
Yeah. And like 20 years ago, you could buy that.
Oh, you get this sense that she was probably somebody that was really wild in the past. Brilliant, but probably really wild and just did some crazy things, but still very, very brilliant. I could totally see that. Getting back to Genesis one second. There is only one thing I had some concerns with in the movie. Phase two was going to be underground, correct?
Right.
So the Genesis cave, where's the sun coming from?
That's what I want to know, too. I wanted to ask you, like, where is that artificial sun? I have
racked my brain on that for 40 years. I was like, I'm sitting there even scientifically thinking, I was like, well, maybe it's just a, you know, they generated some type of fireball in the cave. But even then, it would still roast the inside of that cave to produce the light that it's producing. It would still, if you're underground, it would heat up the inside. So I don't know how the sun came in there. I don't.
Yeah. It is a flaw in that matrix, but as we'll learn, there's a lot of flaws in the Genesis matrix as it works.
Yes.
And so, and I think part of it is, you know, Chekhov says that line is like, does it have to be completely uninhabited? Like, we picked up a micro. We're not even really sure it's there. And Carol Marcus is the one that's like, if there's anything, it's going to throw it all off. But even she says something there that should have been a tip off to the scientists, is that like, this cave grew at an astronomical rate. That's a problem. Like, that's, I know the Hulk magazine survived the eugenics wars. We should know that causes issues when something goes fast. That's not good. And anytime you're a historian, scientists and historians agree in this, anytime something happens fast, it's bad. Like, that's not nothing good comes from speed, you know, except NASCAR. And I mean, that's it. Definitely. Yeah. I mean, really. And most of the time that can also end badly too. So I love that even she realizes there's flaws in this, but she's so caught up in her own creation, she can't see it. Right. You know? And I mean, I think that's a metaphor for anybody that's been in a career for a while and stuff like that. Sometimes you need an outside perspective to come in and go, hey, you're missing what's missing here. The whole survivorship bias idea, you know, like, you're just paying so much attention to what's working, you're not paying attention to what's not anymore because you're missing it. You're missing what's missing. And, you know, I kind of got the idea that like, her and Kirk got together way before he was captain, when he was probably lieutenant or something like that. Cause David's what, 25, you know, maybe. And so, you figured like that was before he got real command, but when he was prone to be spent on anybody's ship, he could have been the helmsman, he could have been an engineer, you know, he could have been anywhere. And where was he going to be around, you know?
If you follow Strange New Worlds and the canon that exists there, that is true, because he mentions in Strange New World when Lon Noonien Singh expresses her feelings for him, he's like, look, I really am flattered, but I'm kind of with somebody and she's pregnant. And you know exactly who that is. And he's a lieutenant on the Farragut at the time. So he's not on the Enterprise. So they hook up when he's still, you know, he's not a captain. He does not have command.
He's a line officer at that point, you know. So it's but I love that there's that whole tension there. They set all of that stuff up. It's great. And the thing is, all of this happens in the first 25 minutes in the movie, because at the 25 minute mark, Chekhov and Terrell meet Khan and his people, and Khan lays out, let me give you a 2-minute episode synopsis of Space Seed. I did my bad, Ricardo Montalban. But Ricardo Montalban comes on the screen, and immediately you're just taken aback at the whole way they've got him made up. He pulls off all this garb to protect him from the sand, and he keeps that one glove on. So you realize like that hand got screwed up somewhere along the way, but he's still just ripped out of his, you know, mind. He looks like the ultimate warrior or something. His silver head of hair, you know, mane flowing back. And he's so in, like, he's just chewing scenery, but then he has like these quiet moments too, where he just sort of pulls down. And I love when he tells Chekhov, like, you never told him about what y'all did to us. You never told the tale, you know, and all these. And I, you know, I know for years people are like, oh, how did Chekhov even know him? I'm like, Chekhov was just a nobody on the ship, you know, just another dude back in those days. He wasn't on the bridge. That, like, that's not a hard guess.
And some people speculate that, a lot of Trekkies speculate that it's very likely that Chekhov was engineering with Scotty. And Khan would have remembered, as he's trying to take over the ship and Scotty's out of the picture, that Chekhov would have most likely been in there getting stuff done. And he would have remembered Chekhov. So and then it was soon, not long after Space Seed, that you do see Chekhov up on the bridge. And I think it's possible that maybe off screen that Kirk decided to promote Chekhov to the bridge because of the role he had in helping get rid of Khan off the Enterprise. So it's not a stretch.
Yeah, I think it's even in like some extended universe stuff where like he was part of the party that relocated them to the planet, you know, so Chekhov has a direct connection. I don't care that it wasn't in the show. I think it's neat that the universe can be big enough that this guy interacted with more than the 8 people we saw him interact with on a television show that was 20 years before.
You gotta remember, this guy's memory is flawless.
Oh, it's incredible.
Khan's memory remembers everything.
Yeah, I mean, he remembers everything. And I love how he does it too. He's like, I don't know who you are. He's pointing at Terrell. It's a great, great scene. He said, I never forget a face. And I just love that. I was like, oh God, this guy's so good. And he's so, that's what's so neat about Montalban here, man. And he only gets, he maybe gets 20 minutes of screen time, this whole movie, maybe 25. And he just destroys,
steals everything. Every part of it.
Totally scene stealer. And it's a wise choice by the filmmakers and the producers to know, we can't just have this guy on the screen all the time. It can't be all about him. you just got to pepper him in just a little bit, because look at what Darth Vader does when he's in Star Wars. He's not in a lot of it, but when he's in, man, it's epic, right? And I think even years later, Jonathan Demme said that part of the way he wanted to structure Silence of the Lambs, because in the book, Lecter's huge in the book, but in the movie, it's only about 20 minutes in the movie, because Jonathan Demme said, I wanted him to be like Khan. I wanted him to just come in at the right moment and then pulling back, because he said, I felt like I had the actor that could do it. And it's so neat that this movie, this little $12 million space movie, has impacted cinema for so much, but it's there. I mean, it's right there. And I love that Khan gets away. And it's so neat too, the way that he puts the little eels in the ears, man. And I got to tell you, as a kid, that just freaked me out, because I was in scouts and in the woods a lot, and I just thought I was going to run into those things, you know, because they were so gross and so horrific. And talk about some good like model work too, man. That's some good eerie looking stuff with those eels.
Yeah, no, that was terrifying. As a kid, that gave me some nightmares. It certainly did. So seeing those worms go into the ears and everything like that. And even when they came out of the ears, down on the Genesis, in the Genesis Phase 2 rock, when they came out of Chekhov's ears, oh man.
Yeah, I mean, it's just eerie.
But then you also get that scene where the worm comes out of his ears and Khan shoots it, and he screams at Khan, probably the most iconic scene in all of Star Trek. Khan!
Yes, so when he's just yelling at it. Yeah, it's one of the best Shatner just loses in his mind moments, because rarely do you see Kurt lose control. You see him get emotional when he goes up and down, but he is losing his stuff at that moment when he realizes he's getting sent off. And we'll come back to that in a minute, though, because I want to talk about Paul Winfield as Terrell, because he has a very small part in this. But as a character actor, you've seen 100 things. You don't know what his name is, probably. But Paul Winfield is absolutely great as the captain here, because I think one of the jokes about Star Trek always is like, why is the captain always going down to the planet or whatever? And what you see is that that's their job. They are the lead investigators in a lot of ways too. So it's not uncommon for a captain to go down to the planet and leave somebody else in charge of the ship, because it's 4/5 automated anyway. So, you know, you just got to, and that's how you train other officers. You let them run the ship and you go do the thing. Right. And I loved him and Chekhov. I thought they had a great play with each other. And then when they're under mind control, particularly when Chekhov is doing that thing back to the regular one, going like, everything checks out, we're coming to pick it up for you because Kirk told us to, and you know he's being fed that offline, and of course they all lose their stuff, and it was tremendous. And then when they get to play double agents for a minute, you know, they get left behind for the Starship Enterprise to find them at the space station after the Genesis team is bailed out, the ones that didn't get murdered by Khan and his people, and they have to play like, oh, it was awful, Captain. He made us do all these awful things. And then you realize like they're just going to turn on them when they get down to the Genesis cave, you know, and it's a great moment when that happens, when Khan is able to enact his first line, what he thinks is going to be his ultimate revenge, is I'm going to maroon you just the way you maroon me, and I'm going to steal the thing that you think is so important and use it for my own purposes. I'm going to beat you again. And all of that happens, though, after one of the most iconic space battles in cinema history. That first round of the Reliant firing on the Enterprise and blowing it to absolute hell is something wild. And I mean, we introduce the idea that can happen in the Kobayashi Maru test. And then you see it for real. And you see the damage that gets done, like the burned people and the sick bay. Lesser movies wouldn't take time to do that and do that scene where that guy from engineering dies and Kirk's holding his hand and stuff. But this one is smart enough to know, we just had the big action scene, we've got to show that there's consequences, because this movie is about consequences.
It is. And speaking of consequences, that young ensign in the deleted scenes, that's actually Scotty's nephew.
Yeah.
He was actually tasked to like bring this guy. This is somebody who Scotty had hoped one day would be, you know, the next chief engineer. And then again, consequences, and this kid dies. Like, he was died saving people.
Yeah. I mean, and he says he didn't leave his post when everybody else.
He didn't leave his post. Everybody else ran. He stayed at his post. And he's like, Scotty in the deleted scene, he is far more tore up.
Yeah. I mean,
he was pretty tore up at that moment, but yeah, it was rough.
Yeah, I do feel like they cut too much of that. I would have had a, I could have used another minute or two of Scotty being upset with that. Like, yeah. Like it's okay for, you know, Bones, McCoy, DeForest Kelly really knows how to put on the affect of the doctor. You know, just, yes. I'm going to be dispassionate and I'm just going to treat people now. I'm just going to do that. And I'll deal with my emotions over some liquor later. Cause that's what happens, you know, with Bones, as we know, yeah. But he's playing that while Kirk is sort of reacting to all these things. And then Scotty's there and Scotty has a moment or two, but you wish he could have had some more, but I want to talk about the, you know, I mentioned last time that Star Trek space battles always reminded me of World War II submarine movies. And this one, maybe no more so than any of them. I mean, it really is. And this is like first round of like something like Torpedo Run, where they just get the hell beat out of them, you know, and right. They've got to go run for a little bit. And in the midst of it, they're done. And in a great, again, screenplay tie-in, Kurt and Spock realize, well, we can get one shot back at them. Let's go reprogram their shields and knock them down, because all these things are in the same cloud together. So we're just going to hack and knock it out. And I'm sitting there laughing, going like, this is Kurt changing the rules again, you know, to get a shot off. And it was a great move. It really was a good scene too. And he just looks up from those glasses, like, it's coming over now, you know, and then they absolutely just fire on him, you know.
That interesting. You mentioned that scene. So that particular scene, apparently Nicholas Meyer had to shoot that scene many, many times because Shatner just kept overreacting with the, here it comes.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, when he kept doing it, and finally Shatner just got tired. And when the scene that they used was the last one, because Shatner was just tired. He's like, here it comes.
Yeah, which is how he should do it. It should be.
Yeah,
very,
and that's
confident.
How that's what Meyer wanted all along, but Shatner just kept overreacting. It's interesting. Speaking of the acting abilities of Shatner in this film, just really quick, we can touch on that a second. Percy Alley gave an interview one time on the Howard Stern show and talked about her experience with Star Trek Wrath of Khan, and she said that Nimoy was great to her. Like, she was she grew up a Star Trek fan, and she used to pretend like she was Spock's daughter. And when she got a chance to like be a Vulcan and be on this and star with Leonard Nimoy, she was like, oh my god, this is great. And Leonard Nimoy took her under his wing and was very good to her. They got along great, but said that Shatner was the weird one. Shatner apparently at one point told her, hey, you should meet with my acting coach and help you with some of this stuff. And she's like, I'm literally playing an emotionless Vulcan. Like, I don't. And so she had like met with this guy for like an hour, and he was some like really on a whole other spiritual plane, just up in the clouds, kind of, I don't know what call you, guru or something like that. She's like, he was very weird. Yeah. So she's like, okay, thank you for your input. I'll just go back to my normal acting now.
Yeah, no, but she's great in this though too. And like the Savick character, to introduce a new character like that, because you've already kind of introducing a new old character with Khan, and we've got David and Carol too. It's good that Spock has a counterpart, because you get this idea that like, oh, Spock dies, we've now got the handoff ready, right? Yeah. We've got this new person we've established, and you know, for Hollywood reasons that never occurs. But I think we get to know Savick in a way and get to see her and Spock really relate to each other. Cause I mean, she talks about like the captain is just so human all the time. Like, I don't get it. And Spock's like, yeah, nobody's perfect, you know? And but cause he's known Kirk for so long. And I do think Nimoy and Shatner are at their best together here. Like, they really seem to be on the same page. There's just sort of a simple, I don't know, a way they are together. I think Kelly and Shatner probably always have the best chemistry together, because you could tell they just get along, and they were good foils for each other, because DeForest Kelly's a good, funny person. You know, he's easy to act against while Shatner's trying to play straight. But when Shatner's got to be the funny one next to Nimoy's straight, it works and it doesn't sometimes. But in this case, it really does. Like, last time, you didn't really feel like they were ever really in the same place together.
Right.
Like, Spock comes in so late in that movie, and that movie's so disjointed in the third act because they're trying to get it done. You know, they're running up against time. This one, there's more room for it to breathe. They really play into this relationship. You know, Spock gives him that book, Tale of Two Cities, from Charles Dickens. And, you know, he's like, am I supposed to read anything? And this is like, of course not. It's just happy birthday, you know, and how are you doing? Hope you're good.
And then, times was the worst of times.
Yeah. And then later when Kirk is going, hey, man, I'm not trying to take over your command. He's like, yeah, you're not going to hurt my feelings. I get it. I'm just the teacher. Like, this is your gig. It's not, you're not going to bother me. But it's almost like this way of how Kirk has always lived his life. He's surrounded by people that are going to make him. It's okay that you can break the rules, Jim. We're going to let you do it. And then now he's got to pay for it. He gets one good moment here with Spock where they figure that out together. And they blow the heck out of the Reliant and it has to limp off to the left, which I got to say, man, the model work in this is tremendous. And I know, again, they cleaned up some of the effects, but a lot of this looks really, so really good.
Especially when they go into the Mutara Nebula. Yeah. I mean, you were talking earlier about submarines and I was reading, I can't remember what it was, like some German submarine movie from the 50s that inspired the filming of that scene.
The Enemy Below with Kirk.
The Enemy Below. Yes. Yeah. Yes. And so it was very like submarines, like, okay, you're in this cloud, you can't raise shields. You can't get in that. You can't see where you're going. Mm-mm. There's no navigational display. Like you're flying blind. Yeah. Like you're barely seeing a scratchy screen. And the scene that always, I think my favorite scene in the Nebula is when the Enterprise comes up behind Reliant the first time, fires off a shot, and then Reliant gets away, and then the screen's so fuzzy, then all of a sudden Reliant turns around, and it's all like when they finally see it, Reliant's there. They're about to collide.
Yeah.
And Kirk's like, oh my God, evasive starboard. And so it was that, I love that scene, but that was also the scene where, the Enterprise, they would fire off some very lucky shots right to the bridge and killed off basically almost everybody of Khan's crew. And that's that single shot there.
They do. And James Horner's music in this, I know he kind of rips himself off a lot in a lot of his scores and stuff, and he's ripped this one off a lot, but it's great. I mean, it knows just when to ratchet the tension up and then when to pull it back. I mean, it's, the guy's worked in Hollywood for decades. You see why. And it's a tremendous score. And I love the Jerry Goldsmith score, no doubt. But this one's just it's more of a rock and roll adventure, because this is more of a rock and roll movie than the last one. Last one's more contemplative. And so we need an action score. And I feel like Horner really gives it that. And I mean, we talked about, Kirk having to deal with the consequences of that first attack and stuff, and the way that they're kind of chasing each other around the planet, more or less to do repairs. When he goes down to the Genesis cave and he gets confronted with David and Carol, they have a lot of bit. We've talked about the cave with the impossible sunlight, but I love how they're talking in code the whole time. And he has to teach Savick a lesson. It's like, nope. When he said 2 days, he really meant 2 hours. And like, you got to speak in code. Everything's being monitored. And what's funny to me is that, like, for all the things that Khan has been able to learn and pick up on, there are some things he can't know. Right. Because he can't know everything, because otherwise he would best Kirk. And they only get the one scene where they're actually, looking at each other. But right before Kirk fires back at him, like when Ricardo Montalban comes on the screen and Shatner's reaction to that and the way they go at each other, it's tremendous. Like it's a good, it's hard to get villain and, chief good guy on the screen together and let them do things. I mean, I referenced Heat earlier, but it is a little bit like that Pacino De Niro coffee scene, but with a lot more, energy going on. But I thought that was tremendous.
Yeah, no, I did too. I mean, but they finally interact, and then when their interactions, few interactions are very, very scene stealing. I mean, right down to the last, where, with a Reliant sitting just completely obliterated and Khan's last words again, Ahab, right there, and having the Enterprise go out. I mean, Kirk just sitting there like,
Well, I love when they talk about, Kirk and Khan are two sides of the same coin, is what we're led to believe here, right? They're both so smart and so witty and so good in the moment, right? But they both have flaws too. And Khan's is like his helmsman, I don't think they ever outright name. I don't know who he is, but sort of his David, if you would.
Joachim.
Yeah. That guy is going like, you got a starship. You've got the remake the world, weapon here. Why are we chasing this dude? Like he's dead. Like they're going to be there. And he keeps telling him no. Fire at him, full phase ahead. We're going into the nebula after him because he's consumed with that white whale, that Ahab.
Well, and it's interesting because Joachim, twice he tried to convince Khan, hey, no, we don't want to do this. You've won. Like the first time was very calm. He's like, this is before they attack the Enterprise. Like, look, you got us off the planet. You've done all this. You've defeated the plans of Captain Kirk. You do not need to feed him again. He's like, hey, he tasked me. And then again, quotes Ahab, I'll chase him around the moon, maybe around perdition's flames where I give him up. And then the second time, was there, they're following the Enterprise and the Nebula. And Joachim's like, if they go in there, you know, we're going to lose them. And so they reduce speed. And the Enterprise goes in, they reduce speed. He's like, we can't follow them. Our, you know, shields and scanners would be useless. And so Khan wanted to interject. He's like, no, he's smart. That's right. And so he's like, that's fine. Go in the Nebula. We can fix our ship up. And then we're going to come in there and they can't hide forever. And then that's when Kirk understands, this is a guy who he's easily riled for all his intellect. Yeah. This guy is so consumed with revenge. This is an easy riled up. He's like, I'm laughing at the superior intellect.
Yeah, he goes like, him into it.
Full impulse power. He's like, no, sir, you can have Genesis. And he grabs him. He's like, full impulse power, damn you. Throws him aside. And he on himself puts the full impulse power with the Reliant, chases him in.
No, I love that too, because there's a moment when they tell Kirk, like, he's slowing down. You know, and he's like, oh, he's not going for it. And Kirk's like, no, I got him. I can reel this one in. And he does. He really, I mean, and it's a heck of a thing to go. I mean, it's almost Top Gun, the original Top Gun, when Tim Robbins is going, why are you letting him get closer? And he says, I'm going to let him get closer. I'm fly by. You're going to do what? You know, and it's the same idea. And I love that Kirk has to goad him into it. And he's so easily brought into it. It's like, no, I can reel this guy in. They have that great battle in the Nebula. But again, there's damage happening because we're trading shots before the Enterprise finally lands the killer ones in there. And everything is blown to hell in engineering. You know, Scotty collapsed from exhaustion and probably gas leaks, all the things going on, right? And when Spock, like, just sort of overhears that and just leaves and quietly goes down there, doesn't say anything about it. I mean, you of course, you know what happens, but it's almost like, oh, you see it. You see it in his head going like, I got to go fix this. I'm probably going to die, but okay, I got to go fix this. And I love how McCoy's trying to talk him out of it. And he's like, well, I probably can't overpower him and there's going to be enough of him. So let me just get him to turn his back long enough for me to nerve pinch him. And then I can do what I got to do here. And, you know, the whole idea of him putting his hand on his face and the remember and all of that stuff, that was all added in later. Like when they,
was that whole scene. Cause then they, you know, eventually we learned about the Katra. You can even kind of tell that was shot a little. If you look really closely at that particular scene and everything else, you're like, that scene looks a little bit differently than all the rest of them. Yeah.
And as Meyer says, I did not shoot that. I have no idea what that is. They seamed it in there just perfectly because film works that way, y'all. But when Spock goes in there to fix the engine or the warp drive, he's, you know, all the light and stuff going all over. Kirk and company on the bridge have no idea what's going on. You know, they're just like, we got to get away because it's Montemont's got so many moments in this, but when he's all blown to hell and he starts turning the Genesis device on and he's spitting those lines, those Ahab lines out or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's just, I mean, I'm just going like, man, this is great. Like, this is perfect. It's very much like James Earl Jones, the last time he gets to talk to Conan in the Conan movie, the stuff he lays on him when he's more or less trying to seduce him to the dark side. It's great. I mean, it's really good. And you're just watching, like, he knows he's dead. His whole ship is dead, but he's going to blow everything to hell with him because it's his last thing. And he's, with the last breath I've got, I'm going to spit it at you as I turn this nuclear bomb on, as it were. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's a powerful scene.
And the analogy there, again, the Moby Dick analogy, not just with Ahab, but the fact the Enterprise was saved, you know, Kirk was saved by his best friend. You know, Ishmael was saved by his best friend's coffin.
Yeah.
So, you know, and this was Spock's coffin, essentially, that saved Kirk and the rest of the crew. So,
they zip off into out of the nebula. It explodes. We get that great look at that planetoid, you know, that's starting to create. And I'm going,
oh, yeah,
that's kind of amazing. Cause, you know, they introduced Genesis as you have to fire it at a moon, you know, or something like that. But firing at a bunch of just space debris and bringing it together, it'll work like that too. That's even, you know, bigger than what they thought it could do.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So it definitely sets up the next movie for sure.
Yeah. But not before we get the emotional wrench of this movie. And it's DeForest Kelly's the one that sets it up. It's like, Jim, you better get down here. Didn't call him Admiral.
Better hurry. Yeah.
You better get down here. You better hurry. And it's like, oh, and Kirk and Spock's final scene together, separated by that plexiglass or that glass, as it were, is, I mean, if that doesn't get you, your wood's wet, you know, I mean, that's just how it, that's how we say it in the country, you know? And I mean, it is so good. And yeah, it's melodramatic and all that, but this movie earns that kind of thing.
Oh, because with all the loss that happened there.
Yeah. We have gone on a journey because Kirk he's gained a son, but he's lost a friend, you know, he's lost his best friend. And he has to go through that. And when he's just sitting there, he can't even cry. He's so upset. You know, he's just like, no, like I lost. How did I lose? And then he's sitting in his quarters later when David comes to see him, you know, and he doesn't know how to deal with his emotions. Like, I poured a drink. He wanted, I'm going to get to the bridge. And David's the one that stops him and makes him kind of just, no, you need to realize what you did. And it was important. And I'm proud of you. And I'm proud to be your son. And they have that moment together. It's so earned, you know, and I think for a movie that is a big action movie, and this movie is in a lot of ways, to have these emotional guideposts and grounding moments that really work is part of its reason that it lasts for so long, I think.
Yeah, no, I do. And, you know, the crew, the cast oftentimes talk about how much they very much enjoyed filming Star Trek 2. And for a lot of them, they're like, all right, maybe they, you know, like I said, T'Kay and Nimoy had to be convinced to come back. But after that movie, was like, okay, we could come back for another one. Yeah, that was kind of fun to do that again. That was different than the first film. Mm-hmm. That wasn't as taxing or as exhausting as the motion pictures. Well, if we want to do it again, we'll do it again. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that scene and then Spock's funeral, the Kirk eulogy. Man, I'm starting to get a little teary eyed just thinking about it.
Oh yeah. I mean, when he talks about like all the souls I've encountered, his was the most, he chokes up and says human. And he almost says it in that kind of gravelly Nimoy voice, you know? And it's the idea of like sacrifice and loss and victory and grief, you know, like you can have the elation of having won, but you have to take account for everything you lost as part of it too. And it's, you know, there's a great book by a social worker psychologist named Judith Voorst that I've told a lot of people about for years. It's called Necessary Losses. And it's about this idea that with everything you do in life, every choice you make, you also make opposite choices to say no, you know, and you let go of things as you gain other things. And that's part of life, and learning how to deal with that is, you know, the human experience and stuff. And that's what we're seeing Kirk get to do here, is that he has to, for the first time, deal with the no-win scenario that he wins, but it still costs him something. You know, if for all that he gained, he costs it. And, you know, they shoot Spock's torpedo, his coffin out into space. And I mean, I look at that as kind of like burial at sea, you know. But like you had questions about the Genesis cave. I'm like, how did that burn up in the atmosphere? How did it stay together? I got questions that we're not going to get answers to ever. So I should just leave them in my bag. But I do wonder.
Well, a torpedo is not going to burn up in the atmosphere. You fired it the right way. I mean, the casings of those Mark IV torpedoes aren't going to fire. I mean, that's why you see in like TV series when they can fire torpedoes at the ground, they don't burn up in the atmosphere. They can just go straight through the atmosphere and attack the ground. So the casings are meant to not burn up in the atmosphere.
Well, and I also reminded myself as I was asking myself these questions, I'm like, well, if you shot a torpedo out of a submarine, but didn't arm the warhead, it's just a big hunk of metal, you know? So it would just,
that's exactly it.
Once the gas ran out, it would just land on the seafloor. A lot of them did that didn't hit anything. You know, they're just buried along the sea. So I get it. I mean, it's fine, but I think it's a good moment to leave us on, because whether they knew it would work or not, the filmmakers left the carrot for the audience to go like, don't you want to see what's inside of that? Don't you want to know? And of course people did, because they came back to see this movie multiple times. It had such a following. And it before the internet, it had the kind of buzz that they knew, hey, we've now got an audience for Star Trek movies. We've got a story to continue. And again, you got the cast reinvigorated. Everybody got reinterested in this again. Like, yeah, I'll do this. Sure. Let's make a little more money. Let's do this. We'll make it happen.
Yes, that's true. Like I said, it was a nice, it was very much a nice, it could have given closure, but it could also tease like, oh, if you want more, we can certainly do more. I like that. I thought it was a nice, great start, great story, great end. This is a reason why everybody considers this the greatest Star Trek movie.
Well, and that's what I wanted to ask you. So we're kind of in final thoughts. Like we said, we're not doing popcorn ratings for these because we like these. So we're going to give them all a pretty good rating on that. But it's mostly just, you know, we talked about Star Trek, the motion picture probably deserves to be a little higher on everybody's lists than where it goes. But I think this one, rightly so, is ranked if it's not the top one for everybody, it's got to be in everybody's top two, right?
Oh, absolutely. I, of all the people I've met that like Star Trek, I have never met anybody where Wrath of Khan was not one or two.
Yeah.
It is definitely, it's the best of the, without a doubt, it's the best of the original series films. It's not even close. I mean, there were, don't get me wrong, there were some good ones. You know, obviously four is a very good one. Six is a tremendous one. But of the original series films, this one was the best, hands down.
Yeah, I have to agree with you on that, too, to play my hand a little bit forward. They never got it as right with the original group again as they did here. And I think it was a combination of a lot of things, bringing in a different couple of eyes and voices to sort of take over and guide it. Mm-hmm. The premise of let's find a good big bad that, and get an actor that can really sell it. And let's have a movie that's pretty simple. You know, we're going to deal yeah. with wins and losses, and we're going to make Kirk face up to responsibility. And that's tremendous. And it's the kind of theme that plays forward no matter where you are.
Oh yeah. And as we'll see later in the podcast, you know, one of the reasons why Star Trek VI is so good is they're like, okay, this is the final movie with the original cast. Let's bring back Nicholas Meyer. Mm-hmm. Nicholas Meyer came in and directed it. And it was, a lot of people say it's the third best of the Star Trek films.
I also say you get the right villain in that too, with Christopher Plummer.
Yes. And
you know, some good old Shakespeare. We're going to have a good time with that. So
yeah, again, you got another quote. You got another bad villain that likes to quote classic novel, you know, classic plays and stuff like that. It's mm-hmm. fantastic. Like it's, we'll get to talk about that a little bit later.
Indeed. But next time we'll be back for the search of Spock, the search for Spock, I should say, Star Trek 3. We got to pick this up. We see we got a little loose trilogy here of mm-hmm. Star Trek 2 through 4. But
the Genesis trilogy. Yeah.
Yes, the Genesis trilogy is a great way of calling it. So, well, thanks, folks, for joining us on this next leg of our Star Trek cinematic journey. You can find the show on all the social media at Filmstrip Pod. Please subscribe. Tell other people about the show. Share the show where you can as well. Go to filmstrippodcast.com. You'll find us, all of our distribution points, but wherever podcasts are found, Apple, Google, Spotify, all those places. Let us know what you think of the show. Give us a positive review. We appreciate your support. So until next time, for Nate, I'm Jay. Thank you for listening to Filmstrip.
Thank you for listening to Filmstrip. You can find more episodes on our website, filmstrippodcast.com. The Filmstrip theme music is produced and performed by Frozen Lake 121. All content used or discussed in these podcast episodes is the property of the respective owners and used under the Fair Use Act, Section 504, C2, Title 17.